Next up, we have Kevin Masterson. I've been working with Kevin off and on some projects under the Amazon watershed. And Oregon, Kevin works for the Oregon DEQ in the and he's a toxics coordinator there, where he implements pesticide stewardship programs with the Oregon Department of Ag. Kevin, come on up.
Thanks, Jason. And been here before, a couple, 3 years ago, to talk about this program. Things have changed a bit since we last talked to you, because we got some funding from the state legislature and got a lot of support from a whole bunch of different groups, which was very gratifying. But I'm talking today on behalf of not just DEQ, but an entire interagency team with Oregon Department of Ag as our co-lead implementing agency. Kirk Cook, he couldn't be here today, but he is working very closely with me on this project. And it really is a series of projects with an overall statewide umbrella. And I'm gonna talk a little bit about background, just briefly, on pesticides and water quality, and then how we're approaching this issue statewide with this team. And then finish by talking about our Pesticide Stewardship Partnership Program, which is the watershed-based work that we do with Jason and others right on the ground. So as you well know, it's a pretty complex picture when you're talking about the number and types of pesticides that are out there. And in Oregon, the Oregon Department of Ag registers over 900 active ingredients in 12,000 different products. So that's a lot of management that they have to do just to register these things. But when you talk about how these things may or may not get into the environment, it's even more complex when you look at all the different types of land uses that may need these products to control pests, weeds, and diseases. And when you talk about the complexity of the different types of formulations, the land uses, and then the different routes of entry into the environment, it becomes even more complex. So we're dealing with different ways that pesticides can get into air, water, and land, and usually when it comes to air drift, we're talking about deposition to land or directly into water. So water is usually the final resting place for these pesticides if they go off target. And we're looking at both ground and surface water, and mostly we're talking about what we term as non-point sources. And non-point sources are sort of area-wide sources, a lot of different smaller sources that add up to a potential issue, and sometimes they don't. And as I'll show with this data, sometimes we're not seeing any problems at all, and that's the power of some of this data. But you can see it becomes pretty complex when you're in an urban area where we're starting to move into more with these partnerships, not just focused on ag anymore, because you have impervious surface. And it goes into impervious surface in a city, it goes through a storm drain and out into a creek. And that is a point source, even though the nature of the contamination is non-point, in that you have lots of residences, you have landscapers and others in a city that are using these products, but it all goes into one sort of conduit into a pipe and out into the river or creek. And so that is one example of a point source. But for the most part, like I said, we're dealing with a lot of different small sources. You get it, all of those into one drainage, and sometimes it can add up to an issue. We also see relationships between groundwater and surface water, where if there are pesticides in the groundwater and it's close to the water table, it can seep into surface water. And of course, we have the volatilization and drift issue. This is just one example of how that might happen in the real world. This is a photograph that was taken when we went out to do a monitoring event in a local creek in the North Willamette Valley, and you can see this potential drift issue that Andy was just talking about, where it could be a non-target drift concern from a hazelnut orchard where they're doing blast spraying, and it could drift over into a grape crop right next door. And then you've got the ditch there that may not only be affected by the drift that's happening on the agricultural lands, but also any kinds of county or state rights-of-way applications that might be happening. So this photo kind of illustrates that complexity that I was just talking about in terms of different routes that these products can get into the water. So as a result, we tried to take a comprehensive look at this. And if we're looking at this multifaceted issue of many different types of pesticides and many different types of land uses getting into in the environment in different ways, we needed all the players at the table. And not just Department of Ag, which has the primary responsibility for regulating pesticides, but then there's a DEQ that has more Clean Water Act types of responsibilities. Department of Forestry manages the Forest Practices Act, and they have a responsibility for protecting water quality, and the Oregon Health Authority when it comes to drinking water sources and protecting drinking water, both surface and groundwater. We all have a piece of that pie. So those agencies got together along with OSU as our technical consultant on this statewide team and developed a plan, submitted to EPA, which was approved. And it's somewhat unique in the United States because in most cases these plans to protect water quality from pesticides are submitted and approved through just the state ag agency. In our case, we have four different agencies that have bought into the same plan, which is great for everybody in this room and other stakeholders because we're all singing from the same sheet of music, which doesn't always happen. So when we look at data, we're looking at it through the same lens, whether we're from the Department of Forestry, Ag, or DEQ. And so this program and the plan that was developed is looking at currently registered pesticide. We still see some of the old legacy compounds show up in water, but our focus is current use of both surface and groundwater, but by and large, focus has been on surface water, and then ag and non-ag areas. We started some of these monitoring and stewardship partnerships in agricultural areas, and it's still a pretty dominant force in our program, but we're also moving and have moved into areas that have a lot of forestry and, as I mentioned, urban areas. And our focus is really collaborative solutions and looking at all of the data that is available. Most of it right now is from this pesticide stewardship partnership program right here that I'm going to talk about in a minute, but we have other studies that have been done in the past since the 1980s, a lot of them from the United States Geological Survey, to give us some background of what has been found historically. These are primarily studies that give you a snapshot in time. They might go out once or twice in a year typically and give you an idea of what's there. The difference between that and the Pesticide Stewardship Partnership Program is we're going out 15 times a year, sometimes in a watershed. We're working with the local growers, we're working with the local ag distributors to find out when some of these products are applied. So we've got a real robust set of data now, but we do also rely on these other studies done by agencies and organizations, both at the federal and state level. So what's the overall thrust of what's been found over the years, especially since we started doing these watershed partnerships? Well, what we found is that in most cases, we'll see, especially in the more complex land use areas, we'll see 20-plus pesticide ingredients, individual pesticide ingredients, in the water throughout a year. Sometimes we'll find as many as 12, 14 different pesticides in a single sample. That's usually in some of the small sub-watersheds where we have lower flow creeks. The good news is the majority of the detections, and this is a generalization, of course, the majority of detections that we've found in all of these watersheds have been low relative to aquatic life and human health benchmarks, the vast majority. But in just about every watershed, we see exceedances of benchmarks every year. Usually they're a small number of ingredients. So if we find 20 or 30 pesticides throughout a year, it might be three or four that are a problem in terms of the concentrations relative to an aquatic life or human health benchmarks. And oftentimes, those are a relatively small number of detections. So we do have this concern on occasion with levels, but we also are concerned about mixtures and the fact that some of these pesticides, because they're so widely used and they're so persistent in water, we see them almost all the time. We don't know how to interpret the impacts of that, but it is an issue of concern. And we're looking at a wide array of ag and non-ag uses of those products. And this slide is a little complex, but it's really intended just to convey the fact that we, as a statewide team, again, this is all four agencies, are looking at the data through a similar lens. We do not have a lot of in-stream Clean Water Act standards for these pesticides. That's why DEQ is involved, not really from a Clean Water Act standpoint. We're working on these voluntary projects because we don't have a lot of in-stream standards for current use pesticide. For the most part, the pesticides that do have standards are the old legacies like Aldrin, D-Aldrin, Chlordane, DDT. And there's no way we could keep up with the chemistries that are coming out of the market. So out of those 900 active ingredients, we might have water quality standards for five. So we do rely on these benchmarks that the EPA Office of Pesticides developed, and mostly they're based on the data that the registrants, the manufacturers, provide to EPA. So this is data directly from the manufacturers that give us enough data to at least be able to compare what we see in the water to something that's going to affect aquatic life or human health. And the important thing that we look at is this aquatic life ratio, which tells us sort of what the worst case scenario might be if we have the maximum concentration that we find in a given year divided by the lowest benchmark. And we have benchmarks, as you can see, for fish and bugs and non-target aquatic plants like algae. So we look at all those different benchmarks, both chronic and acute, for those different species. And the worst case would be the highest concentration we see in the water divided by the lowest benchmark. So if it's herbicides, it's often going to be aquatic plants, the most sensitive species with the lowest benchmark. With insecticides, it's usually going to be fish or bugs. And so we look at those data, compare it to the benchmarks. We look at these other weight of evidence factors. As I mentioned, frequency of detection, if we see something 100% of the time, even though it's at low levels, it's still going to be in our radar screen. It's not as important as having concentrations exceeding a benchmark, but it is something to consider. And then if we're in an area we want to prioritize a stream, well, even if there are low levels and we see 15 pesticides in a single sample, that'll probably be ranked pretty high in terms of trying to get people's attention and focusing best management practices in that area. And the important thing about these benchmarks is, and the reason why we really need them, is that they're not all created equal in terms of toxicity to non-target organisms. As you can imagine, things like bifenthrin, which is an insecticide, has an extremely low benchmark for invertebrates, bugs, and particularly the critters that burrow in the sediment. That's 0.0013 micrograms per liter or parts per billion. That's a really low benchmark. Then imazapyr up here at 24, and we see like glyphosate, which is Roundup, is up in the hundreds. So you can see if we find one part per billion of glyphosate or imazapyr, we're not going to be nearly as concerned as if we see one part per billion of lorazepam, which is chlorpyrifos. And we have seen that exceed those benchmarks on many occasions. So this sliding scale gives us some context in which to view the data. So we take that and that sort of overall statewide context and try to apply it at the local level through these pesticide stewardship partnerships. And they actually predate this statewide team forming and working on the guidance and tools for interpreting data. We really started this very organically, so to speak, in Hood River back in 1999 and 2000 when we were looking at pesticides that did have Clean Water Act standards, and there were a lot more back then. And we had all the organophosphate insecticides, glutathione, lorazepam, malathion, and we were seeing them over water quality standards. And we started monitoring them in Hood River Valley, and it didn't take much to exceed those standards because they're so low. And so the local grower community and the extension agent approached DEQ and said, well, I think rather than going down the Clean Water Act pathway where we develop a total maximum daily load and hand it over to ODA to do an ag water quality management plan, that's going to take, you know, 6 or 8 years to go through that whole process, we think we can solve this problem much faster if we use this data to inform practices on the ground, educate our growers. And that's exactly what happened in 2002 and 3. These voluntary BMPs were developed. The growers got a grant from EPA to develop a handbook, got it in the hands of every grower, did trainings with OSU on drift reduction, and some pretty simple low-tech kinds of practices and improvements. And we saw the effects of that pretty immediately. Other than this little bump up in 2005, we pretty much saw a downward decline right from the start of this project when it came to chlorpyrifos or lorazepam. That was our number one concern in these tributaries to the Hood River. And since 2007, we've only seen it in this lower Neal Creek a handful of times, even though it is still used a lot less, and it's completely legal to use on fruit. We just saw the improvements happen very quickly, and so that sort of concept and model took off to other watersheds. We were actually approached by other grower groups saying that they were interested in this model. It allowed them to be proactive and get ahead of the curve and avoid potential regulation down the line. And they liked the simplicity of it, which was, let's look for current use pesticides in the streams that get there from drift or runoff. We don't want them in the streams. It's sort of a measure of inefficiency. If it's not getting on the target crop, it's getting in the water, that means we need to do a better job. And so that data allowed us to focus on the streams and the pesticides of concern. Like I said, it's not going to be everything that we're going to focus on. It's usually going to be a small number of pesticides are of major concern and a few streams that we monitor that need the attention. And so we'll focus energies in those areas and resources so we're not just scattershot sending our resources everywhere saying, oh yeah, you need to reduce pesticide getting into the water all throughout this watershed. Yes, we would like to send that message, but we really need to be concentrated in those areas where it's a problem, implement those practices, and then follow up over time and continue that loop. So it's a very simple process. Let the data inform how we focus on these issues and continue to do this over time. And we have to stay in an area long enough to see that trend line come down. So who's at the table with us at the local level? It's anybody and everybody that has a role in pesticides management and water quality protection. If any of these groups here listed aren't a part of the partnership, then it's going to suffer. It's not going to be as successful. But we found that if everyone is at the table that has an interest, including the ag chemical distributors and the grower groups, like in the Amazon, we've got SureCrop at the table providing us with a lot of great information, local growers wanting to hear this data, wanting to inform their peer groups, and then the watershed councils and SWCDs are really key partners along with OSU Extension and the folks in Corvallis who provide us a lot of support since we have a lot of experts in this whole field in Oregon. So in 2013, based on the success of several of these pilot projects, the legislature provided funding for the first time to this program. Prior to that time, we were just primarily relying on grants from EPA and other sources and in-kind contributions from Oregon State University. So it was kind of a patchwork we were pulling together. As of 2013, we now have stable funding, which came just in time as we were running out of those soft funds. And they also decided to pull together different pieces of pesticide management that were kind of disparate and not together. That included waste pesticide collection, which we had never had regular waste pesticide collection in the state of Oregon before, like they do in Washington, and then actually put our money where our mouth is and have some technical assistance grants that follow up on the data. We'd been relying on sort of the kindness of OSU and others to use this data to help implement some of the projects they already were interested in, but this actually provided some funding so that we could follow up on that data. So right now we have 9 projects throughout the state and some other pilot projects in South Umpqua, Middle Deschutes, and South Coast that we'll probably be following up on slowly as the resources allow. Our latest project is in the Middle Rogue, and this is truly a multi-use land use area. We're looking at waters that drain from forestry, agriculture, and urban land uses. Amazon, as we've talked about, this is very interesting. I'll talk about this in just a second, where it's actually starts in the urban area in Eugene around Spencer's Butte and goes out into the ag areas. So that's kind of a reverse of what we see in most watersheds. The agricultural producers are getting the impacts of the urban pesticide users. And then we got 3 in the North Willamette Valley, which are primarily agriculture, but not solely. In Yamhill, we have two sites in the city of McMinnville. We're looking at urban use, and then South Yamhill, which is just forestry, and then these 3 stalwart projects that we have in the Columbia Basin, where we got the whole thing started, which is primarily fruit growing, pears, apples, cherries. And then those are the areas we've had the most success because we're dealing primarily with monocultures. In Hood River, it was almost all pears. Cherries in the Dalles, and this gives you an idea of what we've been able to accomplish in the Dalles area in just the last few years. We actually did monitoring in the early 2000s there because they wanted to follow up on Hood River's success. They did a really good job, and we came back in 2010 because they invited us because of the spotted winged Drosophila that was showing up that was going through the unripened fruit on the vine and really threatening the cherry crop in the Dalles. So they wanted to know, well, we're using malathion again because we have to. Is this getting into the water? And lo and behold, we found in 2011, our main baseline year, that 86% of the detections of malathion that we found were over the water quality standard. And again, this is one of the few pesticides that we have in-stream legal standards for. Then we started to get the word out about what we were finding in the water and use that feedback loop to try to reach all the grower groups and the distributors and everybody that was at the table. And we started to see this decline. And this is essentially what we'd like to see in every watershed that we work in. It's really hard to do that in the North Willamette Valley when you've got sometimes 15 different agricultural land uses in one sub-watershed, but we are making progress. But here's an example of where that data and information loop really makes a difference. Just last year, we looked at the data and found that only 19% of the detections were over the water quality standard, and the number of detections is starting to drop. Even though malathion is still in their arsenal, you use it in rotation with other insecticides. So we're able to show this data, and they're able to show this data to fisheries agencies and others saying, look, we could see this really significant decline in just 4 years through a non-regulatory program that was not prescriptive. These are solutions that were developed by the growers and customized locally and mainly included like using weather stations more frequently, doing more ground spraying closer to the streams rather than aerial spraying, those kinds of pretty straightforward common sense methods, and you get this result. The other one I wanted to show real quick was Diuron. So that's certainly a product of concern for the state and something that is used in this industry. In this case, it was used legally by the irrigation district to control weeds on the ditch banks of these distributaries, which are part of the Walla Walla system, but they're used for irrigation. They would spray it in February when the ditch banks were dry, there was no water coursing through it. And then they'd turn the spigot on and a month later in March, and it would pick up all this diuron. partly because diuron has a half-life of about 180 days, so it's pretty persistent for an herbicide and fairly toxic for an herbicide. So we were seeing levels over the benchmark, which is 2.4 micrograms per liter, and average concentrations that were sort of approaching the benchmark. 2012, the growers in the irrigation district got together. They were trying to pursue Salmon Safe certification. All the apple growers were in the area, and they wanted the irrigation district to follow suit. And so they switched to mechanical controls. They're now using burning for the weeds and spot spraying glyphosate in the areas that they need to. And as I said, the glyphosate has a benchmark of like 700, so it's a lot less toxic than some of these other compounds like diuron, and it's much less persistent, so it's not going to stick around. So that was a huge success. And as I mentioned, all of these different practices, whether it's substituting chemicals or doing integrated pest management, like in the Walla Walla near Millen Free Water, and all these fruit growing areas, they've done a lot of pheromone mating disruption projects, trapping of coddling moth to try to target their sprays. And we've seen a huge amount of progress just in terms of reducing drift. This is an example of a nozzle training that was happening in the Pudding River a few years back, where we invited folks in from Extension to demonstrate some of this new nozzle technology that the growers could go out and use and improve efficiencies. And this is one of the areas where if you improve efficiency, you're getting less in the water and you're saving money. Real quickly on the data, I just wanted to give you sort of the big picture of what we're finding in these different watersheds. You can see in the North Willamette and in the South Willamette, Pudding, Yamhill, Amazon, Clackamas, we see a lot more herbicides than anything else. That's because herbicides are used more. We're also looking for more herbicides in our analytical suite. But the ratio of herbicides to insecticides and fungicides is pretty high. And then you get down into these more monocultures where we have the fruit growing. Insecticides are a bigger proportion of the total number of pesticides that we find in the water. The ratio between herbicides and insecticides is a lot lower. And if you look at this from a concentration standpoint, this is just one example of a sub-watershed that we're working in and have got a lot of cooperation from the growers there. This is a fairly low flow stream that is a tributary to the Yamhill Palmer Creek. And when we provide this kind of data, we do show everything that we find, which is in one year, we found 30 some odd pesticides. These are all detections. But when we want to get people's attention on the concentration concerns, we use this aquatic life ratio that I mentioned before. This line here is sort of the normalized benchmark for everything. So if anything is over one, we know it's a potential concern from a concentration standpoint. And again, we're looking at benchmarks that are all different. So when you have bifenthrin and chlorpyrifos with really low benchmarks, we can find levels, straight levels, that are much lower than what we found with AMPA, which is a breakdown product of glyphosate. The levels that we found of that were much higher than bifenthrin and chlorpyrifos, but when you look at it relative to a benchmark, we were really blowing the benchmark for those insecticides. And so what we try to do is get people's attention on the left side of this graph and say, yeah, it would be good to get rid of all of these things in the water, but rather than having our message be scattershot and focus on everything, we really want you to look at these top three or four chemicals that we're finding in the water pretty frequently and over the benchmarks. So it allows us, again, just to focus on the things that are highest priority. And then if we look statewide again, step back and look at statewide data, all of our pesticide stewardship partnership watersheds, all the data, and you look at detection frequency, how often do we find it versus the number of samples that we take? So if we take 300 samples, what percent actually have a detection of any of these chemicals? And you look at diuron, it's way at the top there. 62% of all of the samples that we've taken in this program, which is a lot, have found diuron. And again, it's persistent, it's mobilized by water. It's kind of the perfect storm chemical when it comes to finding it in water. So we're trying to just get the message out. We want to improve practices so that this doesn't get into the water. You look at all of these things, they're almost all herbicides. They're used a lot by a whole panoply of different kinds of users. And so we're just going to see them more. Breakdown products of atrazine and simazine, glyphosate and glyphosate breakdown products, simazine, sulfametron methyl, which is oust, metolachlor, which is dual magnum, 2,4-D breakdown products. So those are all in the top 10, 15. When you look at it from a concentration perspective, it kind of flips everything on its axis, because if we're talking about the frequency of detection of anything that's over 50% of a benchmark, so if a benchmark like diuron is 2.4, anything that we find in the water that's at 1.2 micrograms per liter or greater, what is the frequency of those detections? And it's almost all insecticides. So a lot of those herbicides I showed we find frequently, but they're really low relative to the benchmark. If you're talking about the frequency of things that we find that are over 50% of the benchmark, you're talking about almost all of these being insecticides. So that's two different ways of looking at the data. I did want to show one graph of what we find in an area that does have grass seed, and that's Amazon, Amazon Creek in the Long Tom watershed that Jason resides in and is helping us with this project. And this just gives you an idea of what we find from monitoring event to monitoring event. So we'll go in and show the growers what we're finding so they know, does this match up with when we're using the chemical? And it may or may not. As I mentioned, this is a watershed where it starts in the urban area and goes into the ag area. So you look at the 14 different pesticides that we found at this site, which is an agricultural site on Amazon Creek. Out of those 14 pesticides, 12 of them are multi-use. In other words, they're used by rights of way, they could be used in urban applications, they could be used in forestry. Only two of them are ag-only pesticides. So we have to look at the other contributions. But we also can let people know when we find the biggest impacts on the stream during the year. And if you look at this graph, it shows that most of the time we found between 5 and 8 pesticides in a single sample. In the first monitoring event we did in March, we found the highest level, which was close to 1.2 or 3, and it was diuron, and that is still below the benchmark of 2.4. So this allows us to communicate, yeah, we're finding some clustering of pesticides on certain days of the year, but at the same time, we're finding these really pretty low levels relative to benchmarks. And even the diuron, which is close to 50% of the benchmark, is still below. In the ag areas, I don't think we've ever seen diuron go over the benchmark. And that's definitely not the case in other watersheds. So we can communicate a lot with some of these graphs. I just wanted to end by talking briefly about the other two components of the program, one being the pesticide waste collection, just to put in a plug to look for on ODA's website, DEQ's website, any information about upcoming collection events. We're going to have one in Madras, hopefully in February. We had one in McMinnville just a couple of weeks ago, and we had to turn people away. It was so big. We had almost 50,000 pounds of pesticide waste come in from 45 different growers. It's a great service to offer. We can really generate a lot of goodwill, but it also gets the stuff out of the watershed, which is a real threat to both ground and surface water. And you can see we still find things like DDT. We found quite a bit of DDT and other legacy pesticides in McMinnville. We've also had as many as 400 growers participate over the last couple of years. And these are statistics just for the last two and a half years since we got the stable funding. We used to put these on with grant money before, but 18 events over the last 2 years, so we're able to get around to the entire state, and hopefully we'll get funding again this coming biennium. And then lastly, the technical assistance part, which I mentioned, we have a grant program through ODA. We're we're able, these are fairly small grants, but they've been fairly effective already to get the money into the hands of OSU Extension, grower groups, SWCDs, who can actually implement the BMPs and do the technical assistance necessary. And this is an OSU graphic that kind of gives the full picture of what we're trying to do, this three-legged stool, which is integrated pest management, improved pesticide application technologies like the nozzles, et cetera, and then just best management practices like the use of the weather stations and things like that. Those are the three areas that we're trying to work on to improve water quality and still maintain grower profitability. So it's a dual goal. And two pieces of equipment that were bought right at the outset with this grant money are used to do demonstrations and training. One is a patch spray patternator for anybody that does blast spraying, mainly fruit growing, filberts, hazelnuts, and then a tunnel sprayer. In both of these cases, the extension agents or the SWCDs can take it on the road and train people on how to use these things. The patternator helps in calibrating the sprayers so they're minimizing drift, and the tunnel sprayer basically envelops any trellis crop like grapes or berries so they get a reduction in drift by 99%. Everything is collected in a reservoir and reused. So those are the kinds of things that we've tried to invest in. And that's pretty much it. This is a data-driven and watershed-based program. And I have to again say the data can be your friend, as we found out in many cases. What we don't find can be as important as what we do. Some models might come out that show that, well, we're going to expect pesticide X, Y, and Z in the stream. We go out and monitor, and we don't find it sometimes. So that's really important to note. Any questions?